So I want you to imagine a beautiful, crisp morning. You're out for a walk. You can hear in the background the evocative sounds of nature. You can maybe hear a buzzard in the distance. Then you can hear the mournful cry of the curlew coming over the moors. And perhaps a little tiny twitter, 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 a little bit of bread and no cheese from a yellowhammer hopping from hedge to hedge. Are you excited by the sounds of nature as much as I am, Keith, Camilla?
Absolutely, but the sound of nature approaching is slightly sinister because I'm walking through Blean Woods. The woods are rustling.
I can hear what's coming.
And it's a bison.
A bison?
No, this is a special kind of British bison, not the North American Plains bison, but a thinner, sleek version.
Don't they make a little sort of a low moaning noise as well?
Yes.
On occasion when they're mating? We might even be able to hear that now. Isn't that extraordinary? Keith, what about your sounds of nature? What are you hearing?
For me, I think it's the early morning walk through the woods onto the river with my fishing rod. All of a sudden, I hear quack, quack, which is my interpretation of the young pheasants are running around outside the wood just as I'm going fishing.
And the old moorhen or coot in the background, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't know their sounds.
Well, you could do it in Welsh.
Your bison, Camilla, is a great story because actually the European bison is being reintroduced in a British woodland near you.
Yes, near Canterbury. I'm sort of wondering about the dog walkers and how they're going to reacquaint themselves with this bison.
Well, look, this is a very interesting proposition, and it actually has been one of the reasons that we want to talk to our guest today, who is Craig Bennett, the chief executive of the UK Wildlife Trusts organisation. We'll hear more about them. And one of the local organisations is reintroducing the bison to this bit of woodland in Kent, which Camilla is talking about. And so it's going to be fascinating to hear from him because, of course, lots of focus has been on wildlife and our interest in nature being rekindled as a result of lockdown, being able to hear the bird song because of the lack of traffic noise, etc., etc. And fascinating for all of us, I think, Camilla and Keith.
What would be really interesting to talk to Craig about is the disconnect that happens between the joy that we've all had from wildlife now that we're watching a bit more closely. And yet, when lockdown finished and we all zoomed off to the beach, we walked home leaving a pile of plastic on the beach. So the disconnect is a real problem. And one of the questions for Craig, I think, is how do we deal with that without making it a negative?
Yeah, and I think there's another issue here that's come to the fore for me, and that is the amount of time we've now spent in our own gardens and planting different things that are, you know, attracting different wildlife to our gardens. We will hopefully continue that. You know, maybe people will get that bug about planting things to attract the insects in that nowadays.
So this is Good Charity, Bad Charity, produced in association with the Centre for Charity Effectiveness. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
And next up, we've got Craig Bennett talking wildlife. Craig Bennett has been described as one of the UK's top environmental campaigners by The Guardian, as the very model of a modern eco-general, and has been listed as one of the UK's top social media CEOs. He was previously the chief exec of Friends of the Earth, where he refocused the organisation on empowering communities to take action on the climate and ecological crisis around us. Memorable campaigns there, including bees, fracking, and the anti-expansion of Heathrow Airport. Then he went to the Wildlife Trust, which is where he is now. He was only appointed in April 2020, just as COVID-19 struck. Since 1912, the Wildlife Trusts have been saving wildlife and wild places, looking after 2,300 nature reserves across the UK, operating more than 100 visitor and education centres. We need nature and it needs us. He says, we're here to make the world wilder and make nature part of life for everyone. Craig, welcome to the podcast. And you've joined just as lockdown had started. And what a time to join, because people have seemingly rediscovered the environment around them. You must be absolutely punching the air.
Yeah, and it's certainly a very odd time to start a job. I mean, contractually, my first day in the job was April the 1st, and I think that should have been a bit of a giveaway that it was going to be interesting. But you're right, it's been amazing how suddenly people have woken up to wildlife, and actually more to the point, particularly local wildlife. And that's so significant for us at the Wildlife Trusts. The Wildlife Trusts, we actually have more nature reserves across the UK than McDonald's has got restaurants in the UK.
Wow.
In fact, 1,000 more.
Extraordinary.
And the key point is I think for perhaps too long in the conservation sector, we've unwittingly talked about nature as something spectacular and distant and perhaps sometimes even foreign. But actually, the need to celebrate nature close to where we live is really important. And actually, we estimate that 60% of the British population live within a 3-mile walk of a Wildlife Trust nature reserve. And so what I'm really passionate about coming into this role is actually dialing things up about people understanding not necessarily the very rare nature, but actually the nature that's close to them and the important role that nature can play in improving everyone's physical and mental well-being.
Just to add to that, just something that we've done here as a family, we set up a Minnie's nature table, okay, and we sent a picture to all the kids and the grandkids of what we found in our garden. That took off incredibly well, with all our kids and grandkids then send us pictures of what was in their garden. Now, before lockdown, we just wouldn't have done it.
I mean, that's quite interesting, isn't it? You know, you're talking about getting to a younger generation, talk about using social media. I bet that's part of your strategy now, isn't it, Craig?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And again, one of the things that we've seen during lockdown is a huge surge of interest in how people can connect to nature digitally, which is not necessarily what they would choose, but, you know, that's the way you can do it. So, for example, at the Wildlife Trust, we've seen a 2,000% increase in the number of visits to the webcams at different Wildlife Trust nature reserves up and down the country during lockdown. And you're absolutely right. You know, digital connections are really, really important. But I think too often, again, we might talk about, you know, people either have an online interaction or a real life interaction, as it were. I'm much more interested in how we use one to help the other. You know, there's extraordinary apps now on smartphones that help you identify bird and animal species and plant species that you see. And that means people can actually find out a lot more about what it is they're looking at in nature, learn more about it and so on. So it's really exciting, the opportunities available now for people to build that better understanding of nature, and then they're more likely to care about it.
You're obviously using this, Craig, as part of the whole entity called campaigning, and you come from, you know, one of the greats, Friends of the Earth. What do you think are the ingredients of a good campaign?
Ah, this is one of my favourite subjects, Camilla.
Excellent.
Fundamentally, the dictionary definition of a campaign is a series of activities designed to achieve a specific single goal. I've seen organisations before now that say that they're launching a campaign and they put a lot of effort into a report or a glitzy campaign launch, and only then do they think, oh, what next? Actually, you've got to design in advance, you know, actually a series of activities so that you can build up momentum over time. And then the most important one, a single goal. You know, I've seen many attempts at campaigns where people try and cram far too much in it. But you've got to have absolute clarity of focus. And to give a kind of silly example, think back to the 1970s when you had the kind of Save the Whale type campaigns. What was on the banner was Save the Whale, because it was clear and people could understand it. It wasn't sign this international whaling resolution, you know, and get into the details of it. And I think one of the challenges we have in charities is sometimes as people get more professional and technical, if you're not careful, you kind of lose the ability to actually tell the big picture story that's so important for campaigning.
So is a 3-word slogan absolutely key, do you reckon?
No, I don't necessarily think it is. I always think the first thing is work out what is the absolute outcome you need, and then work back from that to design the critical path to get there. So at Friends of the Earth, for example, we had a campaign, we were really clear, stop fracking. You know, that was a nice, really clear objective. But how did we get there? We knew that it wasn't going to try and persuade people in Westminster and Whitehall that it was a bad idea, because they'd already made up their minds that it was a wonderful thing, because it was this great thing in the United States. I mean, complete rubbish, I would say. But they were convinced on that. That was not how we were going to change that. The only way of changing that was to change the politics at the local community level over many years. And then you bring about the transformational change that campaigning can deliver. And that's the difference between campaigning and just policy or advocacy work, which is important as well, but it's not campaigning.
And so a campaign, I would imagine you transition over time. How do you stop people falling off the edge with either tiredness or boredom?
Well, you have to give people a sense of agency and involvement. So coming into this role, you know, I wanted to try to make sure that the Wildlife Trust, which is a federation of 46 independent charities, how do we make sure that we come together behind a really guiding light? And before I come in, there'd already been some great work by the chief execs of each of the individual trusts, talking about the need for us to focus on trying to get 30% of the UK's land and sea into recovery for nature by 2030. So I come into the world and I think, fantastic, that becomes our guiding light for the next 10 years. And let's launch a campaign to deliver that. Now, we don't try and achieve that simply by rushing into Whitehall and saying to ministers, this needs to happen. Actually, the best way, particularly through our structure with our Wildlife Trust, is to engage people where they live right across the country, in their counties, in their regions, and say, it's very clear from the science this is what we need to put nature into recovery. We've got some ideas about how to do it, but what do you think? All the research has always shown is that if you can give people a sense of agency and involvement on even the simplest thing, it might be planting wildflower seeds or something, then they will be aligning themselves behind the cause, and then they're more likely to do the next thing, which might be eventually go and talk to your MP about it or something.
Just talking a little bit about the structure of your organisation then, Craig, you talk about trying to get a coherent message. Is that slightly difficult when you've got 46 different trusts under your umbrella, as it were, all with their own agenda, probably very locally focused?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that's the model of a movement, really. One of the things that really appealed to me about this job was that structure. And that, I know, goes against where a lot of chief execs come from. A lot of chief execs would love things to be all clear and centralised and, you know, command and
power.
Control. I don't think that's effective. I don't think it's necessarily ever been effective. I certainly don't think it's effective, particularly in this day and age. It's interesting that some of the world's largest corporations are moving more and more to the kind of much more sort of loosely federated structures where there's a lot of autonomy at the local level and regional level. And I think charities have a lot to kind of learn from that. Or in fact, to be honest, actually a lot of charities have done it for years before companies.
Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness is with us. Alex, any thoughts from you?
Craig, I'm really interested in the collective impact of autonomous organisations sitting underneath, you know, the federated structure. What do you think more can be done for the federated charities such as yours so that there's an avoidance of this constant criticism we hear in the media and by vast parts of the public about duplication and the fact that multiple organisations that they see coming under one brand, and I use that term lightly, are not as efficient or as effective in terms of their operation? Do you have strategic direction for your trusts in terms of achieving that?
It's interesting what's happening in the business world is there is a much more a reflection now that this constant drive for efficiency is not necessarily the same as effectiveness. You know, funny enough, we've seen because of COVID-19 that constantly driving for efficiency doesn't necessarily make you resilient. You know, if you've got a 2-day supply chain, that might be efficient, but it's not resilient and it can cause problems. And actually, in the 21st century, what's going to matter more and more is the ability to innovate. And the organisations that are best at innovation are those that have lots of subunits that can get on and do their own thing and try things out and fail and make mistakes and all of that and feel that they have the permission to do that. So again, I think with a federated charity like the Wildlife Trusts, we're a hotbed for innovation.
You talk there about innovation, and there is this extraordinary project which, well, I'll let Camilla explain it because it's actually happening on her doorstep. Camilla.
It's my doorstep insofar as I'm sometimes in Kent and Blean Woods is just up the road from where I am, and they're introducing a ancient breed, I think it is, of bison. Now, that bison is supposed to be helping to control the woodland. I'm not sure how that works. Maybe you can explain it, Craig.
Yeah, it's incredibly exciting. The first thing to understand, as much as that we think we live in a beautiful, green and pleasant land, actually, the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries anywhere in the world. I mean, in my lifetime, 41% of wildlife species have declined in abundance, some of them very strongly. And the biggest problem is that actually our ecosystems in the UK are currently missing some of the key functions that, we would have had species here to, do. Bison were here a few thousand years ago. Sadly, the bison that were here are now, the steppe bison, are completely extinct, but a very close living relative are European bison. And so by reintroducing European bison, we can start to get that ecosystem function that bison perform working again. And particularly what they do is by rubbing up against trees to scratch off their winter coats and so on. Believe it or not, they kill some of those trees, which is a good thing. That sounds weird. I know we kind of all programmed to think we should never hurt trees. But then what you get is rather woodland where all the trees are the same age. You get a mixed woodland where you get young trees and old trees, and you get somewhere there's dense trees, and then you get nice open patches. And that's brilliant for nature, and that's what we need. What we have in the Blean at the moment, that those amazing woodlands near you, is actually some old plantations there. And as Kent Wildlife Trust could be doing, what they have been doing to date, is going out with chainsaws and taking out some of those trees and so on. But that's not natural, is it? And that's using fossil fuels to do that. Why don't we get some bison in to do that job instead of chainsaws? So that's what we're doing. Now, of course, it's in a fenced area. You have to do that for safety reasons at the moment. It's only for bison, so we'll see how it goes. It is essentially an experiment. It's a test and learn. But this is how you start. You know, we started with beavers in enclosures, and now beavers are running free as well. Who knows where this will lead to?
I think that's really interesting. It's cheap labour in many ways, isn't it? Because it's getting nature to help restore nature.
I get a sense that lots of understanding about conservation work is changing. We become more sophisticated in how it can be implemented, whether that's in a rural setting or in an urban setting. I'm guessing there are pockets of land which are becoming available for conversion back into nature reserves as well. That's a big movement, isn't it?
It is. You know, what I said recently is I think if you had to characterise it, perhaps the body language of, say, the Wildlife Trust, but actually the wider conservation movement in Britain over the last 100 years or so has broadly been that of a classic kind of Victorian naturalist, bending down on the ground, counting the beetles and the bugs, classifying them and then taking them away, putting them in drawers or whatever. That's all fine and good. I'm not going to knock that. But maybe one of the things we've done in that, in constantly talking about the species rarity and the classification of species and so on, is actually not done a better job of talking about nature at ecosystem level and actually really helping people kind of celebrate nature in its broad abundance and connectivity. Perhaps at times we've almost, as a sector, been a bit intimidating for people, you know, people that feel that just because they don't know the Latin names of all these species, that they feel that nature is not something they can get involved in. And I'm really keen that for us to be a lot more inclusive, we are saying to people, it doesn't matter if you don't know what it's called. Actually, what really matters is to celebrate and enjoy nature.
Camilla?
That's really interesting, because we're talking about networks, we're talking about looking up, we're talking about bigger picture. But on the website, you look and your patron is HRH, the Prince of Wales. And underneath that sits Sir David Attenborough. Now, they may not be hierarchical. Really, the question is, are they useful? What do you do with them?
I mean, it's, of course, a massive asset to have Sir David Attenborough as, you know, your president, and how wonderful and that he does what he does for us in, helping our communications. But, you know, equally, Dr. Amir Khan, who was recently appointed one of our ambassadors, you know, a young doctor from an ethnic background, clearly he's going to be able to reach audiences that even, you know, the God of Sir David might not be able to do necessarily. So having what I think is really important is having a range of patrons or ambassadors for any charity to help you reach those different audiences.
You mentioned the diversity that's increasingly coming through in terms of your ambassadors. Are there any sort of shining beacons across the Trust who are doing really great work with involving young people in terms of how they can then say the message in a different language to the one that the patrons and the ambassadors are using?
As far as the youth agenda, one of the things I was really impressed about is in the recruitment for my role, there was also a youth panel from our youth network that interviewed me. Goodness, that was by far and away the most terrifying bit of the whole process. And they sort of frog marched me around a nature reserve and asked me questions like, what's your favourite animal and so on. And I thought, oh, goodness, what if I get the answer wrong here? But I think it's fantastic to involve young people actually in a decision like the recruitment of your chief executive. Absolutely brilliant. One of the things we'll be looking to do over the next few years is then try and see how we can get young people more involved in formally in the governance of Wildlife Trust. On the wider diversity agenda, which of course has been very much in the headlines recently, again, there's been some brilliant work going on across the Wildlife Trust in places on this. London Wildlife Trust has really pioneered some great work on this. But I think we've still got a mountain to climb. We know that actually the environment sector is one of the least diverse sectors in this country and is still predominantly very white and middle class. And that's a huge problem. And I think what we've got to be able to do is demonstrate solidarity with other communities fighting on agendas like anti-racism and so on to show that we are kind of relevant and connected on that agenda. So there's a lot to do there.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our guest today is Craig Bennett, the Chief Executive of the Wildlife Trusts. And we talked at the beginning of the podcast about the impact of COVID-19. Clearly, the pandemic has had a very dramatic effect on charities across the board. But very specifically, how has it affected the organisation, Craig, which you had only just joined, let's remember?
So the Wildlife Trusts generally have had very successful face-to-face fundraising through spring and summer at our reserves. But of course, that's not been possible. And so we've seen a big drop of income across the Wildlife Trust during that time. There's also been obviously a fall of income from our visitor centres. We don't charge normally for entry to reserves, but obviously visitor centres and cafes. And so at one point early on in lockdown, we were estimating that we were losing income of around £10 million a month across the Wildlife Trust network, which was obviously devastating. But the real concern about the loss of new membership is, of course, that doesn't just affect us in 2020, it affects us in future years where you'd hope you'd be gaining income from those new members as well.
I'd just like to ask around a subject that is incredibly important for your organisations, and that's around volunteering. You know, what has been the impact of COVID on volunteers, and what steps are you having to take to make that valuable body of support that you receive resilient and future-proof?
Yes, well, it has been a real problem. We've got tens of thousands of volunteers across the Wildlife Trust that have been essential today in some of our conservation work. And of course, COVID and social distancing has meant a lot of that work cannot take place. And a lot of those volunteers are older and therefore perhaps more vulnerable to COVID as well. So we had to be very, very careful about that. Having said all that, I think probably what needs to happen is our concept around volunteering has to change and evolve quite a lot over the years ahead anyway. Yes, there will always be the need for sort of hands-on conservation work at some of our sites where we need to maintain it for particular species and so on. But the whole shift around nature conservation is actually less about conservation and more about putting nature into recovery. So it's less about that kind of manicuring, if you like, of a particular site and trying to get to landscape conservation, which means there's less intensive management. And so that nature does the job, whether it's bison or whatever, that does the job for us that currently volunteers are doing. That's where we kind of want to get to.
I just want to take you on to another issue, really. It seems that you're sceptical about the Green New Deal that has been bandied around. Is it because you feel that that is very vague and is going to end up with doing things that actually won't help the wildlife?
Well, to be clear, I'm not sceptical at all about the concept of a Green New Deal. What I'm sceptical of is the government's rhetoric to say that that's what they're doing when they're clearly not. You had the Prime Minister's speech recently called Build, Build, Build. You know, charities and business and so many other commentators have been talking about the need to build back better. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister forgot the better bit and just focused on the build and didn't get the memo about the need to do it better. And yet public opinion polls show very clearly that the vast majority of people in this country don't want things to go back to exactly how they were before, but to actually have a better economy as a result of this. And to give some illustration of that is the government's kind of given out £40 million for nature restoration projects in their recent announcement. And they said that's an example of a green recovery. But when you put that alongside £27 billion currently earmarked for new road building, much of that through some of our most precious wildlife sites, you know, how is that? How does that add up to a green recovery? It absolutely doesn't.
Can you sort of turn it around? Can you, from the, I suppose, the tradition of conservation being seen as something of a left-wing persuasion, can you turn it around and say, well, look, you know, conservation done to scale is effectively a plus point for the economy and a plus point for the free marketeers, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. And the amazing thing about projects that will put nature into recovery is that can happen right across the country. You know, you could spend 100 billion quid on HS2 or something and it will cause devastating impact on the environment, but also actually it will only really benefit the really big construction firms and perhaps, you know, economically a particular region or two. Whereas, actually, if you invest in energy efficiency right across the country and if you invest in projects that will put nature into recovery, every single bit of the country can benefit from that. And you can train up young people in apprenticeships for the skills they need for the 21st century right across the country rather than just in one location.
Craig, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Unfortunately, I do have to ask you three very quick questions, which if you prepared yourself for your junior interview panel well enough, I'm sure you can answer at the drop of a hat. Favourite mammal, favourite bird, favourite wildflower?
Oh, goodness. I would say beavers, just because of what beavers represent about wildlife coming back. In bird, I think it has to be kingfisher.
Oh,
I just adore kingfishers and that beautiful flash of blue, which you don't see otherwise in nature. And favourite plant? Oh, that's going to be a tricky one. Daisies are pretty beautiful. What I always find funny is that people that are trying to eradicate daisies from their lawns, thinking that they're weeds. You know, a dictionary definition of a weed is simply a plant that is growing somewhere where you don't want it to grow. So the way I do the weeding is sit in my deck chair and just decide, I want all this stuff. I'm very happy to have daisies on my lawn. And then, you know, that's how you do the weeding. Yeah. And they're beautiful,
brilliant,
aren't they?
Craig, we will banish you to a desert island inhabited by kingfishers, the odd beaver and some daisies. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing
your
knowledge.
Thank you very much.
So you've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We've been talking to Craig Bennett of the Wildlife Trusts. Camilla, what your initial reaction, your takeaways?
Wonderful messages from a real campaigner. Simple, let's put nature into recovery. And his final keyword, which we keep banging on about, is charities are in a great place to be innovators.
I mean, isn't it extraordinary as well? He talked about all of those ambassadors that he has lined up to talk about wildlife, but ultimately the brand ambassadors are the stag beetles and the bison and the beavers and the ragwort, for goodness sake, aren't they?
They are, really. You're right. And, OK, he's in a lucky position, isn't he, to have big names where people look up to or listen to. And we need to make sure that all the smaller charities can try and maximise their ambassadors as well.
That's brilliant. Alex, any final thoughts?
Yeah, my final thought was, you know, Steve Jobs is in quotes talking about the most powerful person in the world is the storyteller. And I think how Craig had those sound bites, you know, so succinct, but very powerful, and using the wildlife to really tell that story and to engage with people at an emotional level that will really create the bond through using stories, and then moving that through, bringing in his digital experience from his previous role. I'm really hoping that he'll be able to engage with many, many more people.
Master of soundbite, but he didn't do the obvious joke, which I thought was a bit of a shame, which is, what's the difference between a buffalo and a bison? Keith?
The answer is you can't wash your hands in a bison.
No, hang on, it's the other way around.
Buffalo.
You can't wash your hands in a buffalo. Never a man to undersell a punchline, ladies and gentlemen. Keith Davis, thank you. So you've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We'll be back again soon with another episode. Our thanks as ever to the Centre for Charity Effectiveness, Alex Scales, who's been with us. And don't forget, goodcharitybadcharity.com is the place where you can go and find out more about our episodes and even donate and support our podcast if you wish. We also have the Twitter handle at GCBCPodcast. Our thanks as ever to Dan Hardoon. From us all, a goodbye and stay safe.